Okay, this is the hour. We'll take your phone calls with Frank DeMarco right here on Coast to Coast AM, After Life Conversations with Hemingway. And more to come when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Frank DeMarco, who claims that he's had afterlife conversations with Hemingway. Frank, did Hemingway say anything like, you know, Mahatma Gandhi is with me or anything like that?
Well, we've had mutual conversations with Carl Jung and Maxwell Perkins, his longtime editor. Abraham Lincoln came in at one point.
Well, tell me about that one.
Well, we were actually talking about Hemingway's reaction to some of the things in his own life, some of the traumas, and some of the things he had a hard time forgiving. And I happened to mention that Lincoln's way was to basically forgive people and go on with his life rather than brooding on things. And one thing leading to another, Lincoln actually came in and discussed it a little bit, basically saying that...
You're moving, by the way, again. You're moving.
Yeah, I can hear the thing, too.
Yeah. Are you cordless or cord?
No, corded.
Cordless?
No.
It's a cord. It's the cord that's making the noise, I think.
Well, we take the cord off, but I don't think it'll work as well.
No, not at all. Then we have what we call real dead air.
Do you remember that happened last year?
Yep.
It was so early in the morning, I couldn't figure out how to put it back.
Yeah, thanks.
I was really out of it.
Anyways, go ahead. So, Lincoln.
Well, that was the essence of it. Lincoln was basically saying that in his life, he found it wasn't worthwhile to pursue grudges, that many people did things to you, and if they intended to do it, that's one thing, and you couldn't do anything about it. And often they didn't intend to do things, and there wasn't any point in doing anything about it anyway. But that was just a short answer to your question of did other people show up.
What about reincarnation? I mean, why hasn't he been reincarnated? Why? How come he's not gone?
Actually, he said he did and wouldn't talk about it. And that was okay with me because I can understand that.
So he's been back there and back.
Yeah. And then the same as you and me, I believe. It appears that, this is a slightly longer subject. There's two things, spirit and soul. And spirit is what reincarnates. The soul could be described as the mind you form in this lifetime. So the George Norrie soul is not reincarnating. That George Norrie soul will always be on the other side, available to interact, just as you have been shaping it in this lifetime. But the spirit underneath you could reincarnate, and it would form another soul in another, you know, another environment, different heredity, different circumstances. So it's sort of misleading to say he has or has not been back. The answer is yes, he has. No, he hasn't. Depending on how you want to look at it.
Let's go to some phone calls for you. Let's go to Janet in Dubuque, Iowa. Welcome to the program. Hi, Janet.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I do love Hemingway's work, and I actually grew up not far from the big two-hearted. But when I got to college, I had problems in English class because whenever we got to the Hemingway, someone would sit there and say, what Hemingway really meant was... And my curiosity about his writing, which just had, you know, never a spare word, was he going just to try to spin a good yarn, or was he trying to draw, you know, like metaphorical connections to some other situation?
All right. That's a great question. Think about the odds, by the way. How did you get on the air against the odds of hundreds of other people trying to do the same thing? Wonderful. Hemingway actually said he had three revolutions that he was basically... engaged in, and one was to cut out all the flowery extra words that had come in over the years as the Victorian language had become more and more flowery. Another was to actually go in and describe situations more honestly. For instance, if you couldn't, and there goes his phone again.
You guys saw you do hear it.
Yeah, I can hear it, but I don't know why it does that. You know that Hemingway engaged in a lot of they weren't quite legal battles, but he wanted to use words that were unacceptable at the time and were actually in some places illegal to use. The words that we hear all the time today, partly because of the fact that he won. But the reason he did that was not because he was addicted to dirty words, but because it falsified the language. So on the one hand, he was trying to strip down the language and make it as honest as he could. And on another part of that same battle, he found that if you couldn't say certain things, you couldn't describe certain situations, and if you couldn't describe those situations, you couldn't make an honest statement of what was going on. And the third one was between the lines, and that was that he was really, I don't even know if he knew this in a lifetime, I don't know that we've talked about it, but his way of writing requires something of the reader that other ways don't. You know of his famous iceberg theory, where he said seven eighths of something is underwater, out of sight. He left out everything he could leave out, and so that you could, he left out everything you could leave, he could leave out, and you still be able to read the story. But often, if you didn't understand what he had left out, if you couldn't put yourself in the middle of it, you couldn't make sense of the story. The famous story Indian Camp is a good example of it. A lot of people just don't make sense of the story because he left so much out. What he was doing was requiring that you actually be so much into that story that you understood what hadn't been said. Now, that's a whole different way of writing.
Was he successful as a writer at the time when he was alive?
Oh, yes. Oh my, yes. He was so successful. He explained it to somebody once, and this isn't something I got. It's something from one of the books I've read. But he said that he had made such a name for himself that he made the magazines pay the price that would pay for the 9 stories they wouldn't publish as well as the one they would publish. And that's why he was able to succeed.
Wow. He dictated and they acquiesced, huh?
Well, there's a man named Arnold Gingrich who founded a magazine you may have heard of called Esquire.
I sure have.
He was always grateful to Hemingway for having been with him right from the beginning. And it was very mutually profitable because Hemingway's name, he was able to use his name to go and get other writers. Right from the start, he's founding a high-end magazine in the middle of the Depression, but he's got Hemingway's name, and other writers were willing to work for him. And it was helpful for Hemingway because it kept increasing his own visibility and increasing the value in the marketplace.
Let's go to Mark, Wildcard Line, Florence, Oregon. Mark, you're on with Frank DeMarco. Go ahead.
Hey, good evening, George and Frank. Good to speak with you.
You too.
Hey, Mark.
Hey, Frank, I heard you on Ian Punnett's show on the day, or rather the evening of the day that Michael Jackson died. Do you remember that?
I don't think that was you, Frank.
Could have sworn it was. I'm sorry I missed that, but I have one other question real quick.
Okay.
And that is, Frank, I heard recently from a researcher that actually Ernest Hemingway was persecuted quite heavily by the federal government in this country, and that they had attempted to, or had actually, I believe it's attempted to, but were aiming or threatening to have him committed. And if you hadn't already covered that previously in the show tonight, I was wondering if you'd heard anything about that, and maybe it's something you can file away and research on a little more personally with Mr. Hemingway if you have the opportunity.
Well, we've talked on that, we touched on that somewhat, and I got a slightly different story, and that is when he supported the Republican side in the Spanish Civil War, he, like everybody else who was on that side, they got a file in the FBI, and the FBI kept track of him and kept a dubious eye on him. Then later, during the years after World War II, the FBI continued to watch him. Now, during the war, he was active. He used his own boat as a Q boat, looking for submarines in the Caribbean, along with hundreds of other people. So he was actually working for the Navy as a civilian. And then, of course, he went over to the European front, and he reported for several months after D-Day. Nonetheless, he continued to have his files. The FBI continued to cast a fishy eye on him. J. Edgar Hoover never forgot anything, apparently. And Hemingway was persuaded that the government was after him. People at the time were convinced that this was his increasing paranoia, which apparently was true. I mean, it was true that he was becoming more paranoid, but it's not necessarily true that he didn't have reasons for it, but we don't know that. It doesn't appear that the government was attempting to get him institutionalized. At least nothing has surfaced to that. But what it does appear is they had continual, certain aspects of the government anyway, had continual suspicions about him I suspect now they knew more about his sympathy for revolutionaries than they ever would have admitted. That's as much as I know. And
what would they have done to him today, knowing what they might have known? Anything?
God knows. The government today seems to do what it wants.
I wonder what he'd be writing about today.
Well, that's an interesting question. He was not a political man, actually. You might think from all I just said about revolution that he was, but he wasn't like he was not a leftist ideologue the way some people seem to think that he was. Mainly, he was about living your life in a full way here, physically and mentally, or I should say intellectually and emotionally. You know, he lived. He was a hunter and a sportsman. He was also a writer and a reader. Read everything. So whether he would be politically involved, I don't know. There's no way to know. I haven't really talked to him about it.
Let's go to Laura, Pensacola, Florida. Hi, Laura. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much, George. I'm about a 20-year listener.
Oh, thank you.
And first time. But I have a quick question for you, Mr. DeMarco. I'm fascinated. I grew up, my father passed away about 18 years ago, but he was an avid Hemingway beyond a fan. I mean, I remember growing up with he had a bust in the library of Hemingway, and he had all of his recorded albums, and he made my sister and I read all of his books, and we were like, oh, God, you know, and it wasn't until later in life and in philosophy classes that I also started going, wow, this makes perfect sense. Where have I heard this before? But the question that I have for you is, and you sort of touched on this with the previous caller, have you, in any of your posthumous conversations with him, has he ever indicated a regret for having taken his life? Because everything that he ever wrote seemed in such contradiction to that. I mean, it's like you just said, he was all about living your life to the absolute fullest.
Yeah, with a zest, right?
Yes, absolutely. And my father was very much like him. and a lot of the life lessons that I've learned came from things that my father taught me through his sort of Socratic method of teaching, which is similar to a lot of what I've read in Hemingway's books. Uh-huh. But I wonder if, if he's ever mentioned having regretted taking what he had to offer and sharing his, hey, you know, he don't just exist, live type of attitude away from others.
We have talked about that. I would say that his regret really was that he felt his way had run out. He had lost his physical ability to enjoy things. He'd lost his mental ability to compose stories or even to remember what he had known. And I don't think he felt he had any future that way. What you say is absolutely true. He criticized his own father for having killed himself back in 1928, and he criticized him bitterly for years as a coward. But over time, and especially after he killed himself, he came to realize sometimes it's almost like it's the only real alternative you have. It isn't that he wanted to get away from the life that he had lived. It's that the life that he had left was hopeless for him.
And tragic way he died. Put a shotgun up to his mouth, blew his brains out. Horrible.
Well, it's a bad way to leave. It's not necessarily a bad way to go. I think he regarded it as the way, what he used to call a family exit. He regarded it as a way to get out of an insupportable situation. Because he felt anyway, that the next step was he was going to be institutionalized, and he did not want to spend years in an institution.
Was he fading that fast?
He was physically in terrible shape, and mentally he wasn't in great shape either. He really did have mental problems that were making it impossible for him to see life straight. He was being overtaken by paranoia and by other things that are quite unpleasant.
Well, and, you know, he died in 1961. We did not have nearly the kind of science and the medical health we have available today.
So they would not have done today what they did then in terms of shock treatments.
Apparently. No, not at all. Of course, they probably would have put him on Prozac or something like
that. Well, yes, thank you. I was going to say, I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean we would have done better. We would have done different. And Carl Jung talked about this and about the beginnings of his illness. And the interesting thing is, Jung would say this, at least to me, to us, he would say, that there's a saying of his that has been quoted that said that all mental illness is the result of a refusal to bear legitimate suffering. And the way he translated that was, Hemingway falsified his memories because he had such a tender conscience he couldn't bear to admit to himself that he had been wrong in certain things. When you falsify your memories enough, you wind up lost. You see, you lose track of what actually happened. You got to make up stories so that everything in your life that's wrong was the fault of your mother,
that's right,
or your wife, or, you know, some ex and such. And so that didn't, you know, you really can't blame that on medical science, can't even necessarily blame it on physical problems. It's really an unfortunate side effect of some of the problems he had as an individual. He certainly was not a perfect man. He was just an extremely complex and well-rounded man.
Let's go to Seattle, Washington. Mary, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Mary.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm so thrilled to get to speak with both of you. And Frank, I talk to the other side the same way you do, and I'm so glad to hear it. I finally found somebody that I can reach out and touch that would understand. And my husband died. I had a little one that was 3, and it was a very difficult situation, and I had a business to close, and I didn't know where to start or what to do. And he just started talking to me, and he told me for 18 months, every morning, I would go in and sit down, and he'd say, what are we going to do today? And I would tell him, and he would tell me where the paper was. Or one time there was a banker I needed to talk to, could not remember her name. And I sat there and flipped his Rolodex, and the card shot out of the Rolodex. I picked it up, and there it was.
Aha. Excellent. And if you tried to explain this to people, they would try to make it into something supernatural, right?
There's no doubt about that. Frank, we're almost out of time for this half hour, but we're going to come back with some final calls with you. But where can we get your book, Afterlife Conversations with Hemingway?
It's on Amazon. It's on BN.com. You can get it from RainbowRidgeBooks.com. That's my publisher. That's Bob Friedman, who used to be my partner in Hampton Roads. RainbowRidgeBooks.com.
Okay, super. Stay with us. Coming back, final phone calls with Frank DeMarco. Split show, so let's come back with some more calls. We'll be back. Well, every Wednesday, a Coast to Coast listener gets to sound off. You can, too. Send your sound off to editorial@coasttocoastam.com. That's the email, editorial@coasttocoastam.com. Put down the information that you want to sound off, and we may call you, and you may record it just like this.
Hi, this is Kathy from Las Vegas, and this is my sound off. They can fly into outer space, and they have not found a cure for cancer after 50 years of scamming donations off the public. When the cure for cancer was discovered in the 1930s, but suppressed by the AMA, Big Pharma, the insurance cartels, and our government that is run by the Illuminati. And Jerry's kids are lucky if they can play wheelchair basketball after all these years of research funded by public donations. What is wrong here? Has it occurred to anyone that cancer is big business for the AMA, Big Pharma, and the insurance and hospital industries? My mental tsunami hit shore now. This is Kathy from Las Vegas, and this has been my sound off.
Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Frank DeMarco with us, author of Afterlife Conversations with Hemingway. Frank, back in 1996, the granddaughter of Hemingway committed her own horrible situation, a suicide, 42 years old, Margot Hemingway. She took pills. Did he ever talk about that?
No, didn't talk about that. But she's not exactly alone, you know. His father killed himself. His brother killed himself. His son Jack killed himself. His son, I don't think Gregory did kill himself. I mean, it's been an epidemic in their family.
What's causing that? There's got to be something genetic in there.
There could be. There certainly seems to be some predisposition towards manic depression, but I don't know. It may be that they are all regarding it as the family exit, the same as he did. His one son, Jack, once said he wanted to die a normal death just so they could find out how long a Hemingway male could live. But I think in many of their cases, I don't know about Margot, but in many cases they were faced with something that they didn't want to live through. I believe somebody was looking. His father was afraid they were going to amputate his legs because he had diabetes. At least he was pretty. His father was a physician. He was pretty sure he had diabetes, and it was going to reach that point. And he just didn't want to live like that. And I think there was something similar to Jack. But no, this isn't something we discussed.
Did Hemingway ever laugh? Did you ever hear him laugh?
Oh God, we joke with each other all the time. Yeah, he's funny.
Is he?
Oh yeah. Yeah, he's a very vital, very, very engaging man.
What's he think of current affairs today?
I don't know if you're going to understand this, George, but in a lot of ways, current affairs aren't as important as internal affairs. People are sort of, and I mean, I'm hearing all your promos as I listen on the air.
Yeah.
And then people are concerned about the Illuminati or about government or about economics or about health and all that, those things. I'm not saying that they shouldn't be. But at the same time, there's only one person on earth that you're really responsible for, and there's no one else in the world who can do what you can do about yourself. And working on ourselves is the most important thing, and it's really the only real thing we can do. Now, it may be, as say, take Abraham Lincoln, in working on himself, in becoming the person he was important to the nation. He was important to the world. But you can't say that somebody came into the world primarily to do something other than live the life he was living, if you see what I'm saying. So Hemingway has often been talking about his own life as it really was, or aspects of it that aren't understood. But it also there's a sort of an ongoing conversation between us about how should people live? How should they regard this phenomenal opportunity, which is life in the physical body? How should they make the most of it, you know? And I know that a lot of people believe in accidents and they believe in chance. And if you do, that makes your life harder, I think. But if you look at it a different way and you say that everything external in your life is a reflection of something internal in yourself, then everything becomes an opportunity rather than something that makes you into a victim. And I'm not saying that that's what Hemingway necessarily understood when he was in the body, but he certainly understands it now.
All right, back to the calls we go. Let's go next to George in Alton, Illinois, first-time caller. Hey, George, go ahead.
Yeah, George, how you doing? I've been
for
40-plus years.
Thank you.
Are you there?
Yeah, go ahead, George.
Talking about Ernest Hemingway, I go to Key West, Florida every year, and they got stories of him down there and all the bars, and I guess he spent his winters there for years and years from what they're saying. But
he actually lived there year-round for about 11 or 12. Go ahead.
They got pictures of him and all. I mean, you go to all them places, there's pictures of him all over the place and the little cats that he had and all that kind of stuff they talk about all the time. And yeah.
Yeah, well, he was one of a kind.
I visited Key West early last year before this book was actually written, and it was an interesting experience to be in the house that he lived in and to sort of feel his presence. I don't mean that in any inflated way, but just as anybody else, you walk through the house and you remember he actually lived here, you know.
I mean, wasn't he in World War One?
Yes, he was the first American to be injured on the Italian front in 1918. Now, there had been one who had been killed ahead of him, but he was the first one to be injured.
You know, it's hard to believe, you know, he dies in 1961, that he was in World War One. It sounds like he just lived almost forever.
Well, think about it. He was born in William McKinley's first term.
That's weird.
Yes, an amazing thing. And another thing people forget, you know who his boyhood hero was? Theodore Roosevelt. You read a biography of Theodore Roosevelt and you see what his characteristics were, and he was so much like Hemingway in so many ways. In fact, when Hemingway went on his safari to Africa in the 30s, one of the things that he tells me is that had kept it in his mind is that's what Roosevelt did after he was president. You know, the first thing he did, he went off to a safari in Africa.
What do you think his best book was, A Farewell to Arms or For Whom the Bell Tolls?
Boy, I would have, and the third one would be
The Old Man in the Sea.
Well, gosh, George, and then you got to say The Sun Also Rises.
Yes, they were all good.
They're all phenomenal. I reread them every so often. And now, the Old Man and the Sea is a very interesting thing.
And they were all made in the movies, too, weren't they?
Well, yeah, but I don't... The Old Man and the Sea is the only movie, I think, that they made that he liked. I don't think he liked the other ones. But, although I may be wrong on that. I want to tell you, though, he used to talk about writing in the fifth dimension, and not everybody understood what he meant. And I certainly didn't until he explained it to me. And he said that The Old Man and the Sea was when he had achieved the fifth dimension that one time. And it was almost like more like a gift than like an achievement. And by the fifth dimension, what he means is the fourth dimension takes a certain view of life and reveals it. We can't do this in just a couple of minutes. The fifth dimension is almost like a God's view of the world. I'm sorry. It's in the book. I really, there's no way I'll be able to put it into a couple of words.
Understand. Let's go to Dan, Augusta, Georgia, east of the Rockies. Dan, go ahead.
Hey, how y'all doing tonight?
Good, Dan.
Man, I'm really enjoying your show, and I just want to thank you, George, for hosting the best show on the radio nowadays.
And we're very welcome.
The variety of topics and just how interesting it is and how open it is, and enjoying your listener tonight, too. But I was just going to ask him, why would Hemingway, if he had such a great life, why did he see the need to drink so much? Do you think that had something to do with his mental downfall?
Well, I think like any other addiction, it would, but we've had arguments about this because he says that he got more out of drink than drink ever got out of him. It appears like this. When he was creating, he would be in a certain mental space, and you can only do that for so many hours a day. And when he left, then he felt he needed to sort of change gears. And he not only did things like physical activity, like fishing, say, but he also came to use drink as a way of sort of changing mental spaces, because if you're writing, it's important not to keep thinking about it until you go back to writing again. Now, there's a lot to be said against that, but that's what Hemingway would say in favor of drinking. I think he did too much drinking. I think it hurt him, but that doesn't mean he would sign off on that.
Does he give us any scary message, Frank? Is there anything there that is upsetting?
No, not that I can think of.
So
no, it's actually very hopeful, very, very positive.
All pretty enlightening?
It is, and it's designed specifically so that people, when they read it, will realize that they have more potential in their life than maybe they realize.
Next up, we go to Mike in Scottsdale, Arizona. Michael, go ahead.
Hey, George and Frank, this is awesome, and thank you so much for taking my call. This is such a memory to me. I know exactly where I was the night that Hemingway supposedly shot himself in the head. I was sitting in the war room in Tarjon Air Base in Madrid, Spain, outside guarding the war room. And I got the printout on the entire life of Hemingway and his supposed suicide after the publishers rejected his last book as it was written and told him he had to redo it or pay them back. And when I read that, I had to read it several times over. And when I was through some of the things you've said here tonight, and the fact that I actually took him as a social drinker in the majority of his life, and very friendly, and he was in Spain many times and sat out on the sidewalks and talked with people, and he was friends with bullfighters. And did anybody ever come up with the possibility that he was not, in fact, a suicide, but was murdered?
No, and I find that very hard to believe from everything that
you know. When you read, as I read his almost entire life story, I just found it hard to believe that he should be so upset that he could not fix that book and submit it to the publishers and had not the cash in hand to pay it back.
No, I think that's mixing up a couple of stories. One of the problems that he had mentally was he was persuaded that he was about broke and that he was going to lose everything, whereas in actual fact he was flush. He had plenty of money, but they couldn't persuade him. Just as when he would go off, he'd be ready to fly on an airplane, and he always had huge amounts of excess luggage that he would pay, you know, to have on. he became convinced toward the end, oh, they won't take the luggage and I'll lose all my luggage. You know, these were irrational fears. They weren't rational fears. And the thing about his book being, there was no book that I'm aware of that was even considered to be unpublishable. A Movable Feast came out a couple of years after he did kill himself, and it was basically in the form that he had left it. I think it's mixing up a couple of stories. I'm glad you mentioned Spain, though, because he did love Spain, and he talks about Spain quite a bit and about the way that the 20th century was very hard on Spain.
Back to the calls. Joe T. in Roanoke, Virginia. Hey, you're on with us, Joe T. Go ahead.
Yes. Oh, my God. Okay. Oh, you know, I called you a couple of months ago, and then I got cut off in mid-sentence. But first of all, hi, Frank. I am Vernon Kitabu's Turner's sister, and I'm a friend of Bob Freeman's. And I hung around with Hampton Roads Publishing for years, going to all the book signings and dinner parties with Bob and my brother. So I remember
you. I will tell Bob you called.
But anyway, I have to say this. Hemingway is one of my favorite authors. And I just gave away my 1952 edition that Hemingway's wife put out of Old Man and the Sea, which is my favorite story. And I'm reading again, The Sun Also Rises Now. And George, I want to tell you that I really loved you. I've been listening to you for years. I'm crazy about this program.
Thanks, Joe.
And
it's
I don't
let
you sleep.
Well, all right.
Because I listen every night.
Stay awake.
it's almost three here, George.
Well, you're almost done, Frank. You're almost done.
Yeah, but you're telling her to stay awake. But Roanoke's the same time zone as.
Oh well, yeah, but I've got the rest of the show to do after you're gone. Let's go to Joe in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
Hey, I just wanted to call in and say that I think that I can describe that fifth dimension in just a few short words.
Sure,
try go.
It's just the concept of the collective mind that's talked about in Eastern mysticism.
It might be. Go ahead.
And also, when you were talking about when a caller asked the reason that he turned to alcohol, it was because early on, Hemingway couldn't deal with the gifts that he was given. He didn't quite understand them, so that turned into sorrow. And he looked to the bottle to drown that sorrow, later on discovering that it was actually a tool for his writing.
Do you think it was a tool for his writing, Frank, the drinking?
Well, I think he used it that way. I don't agree with the description of how he came to drinking. I think having been raised in a teetotal family in the Midwest, in Oak Park, which is part of Chicago now, he found life in Europe to be a tremendously liberating experience, and he dove into alcohol with the same zest that he dove into everything else. And perhaps he hit his head on the bottom.
He was obsessed with everything he touched, wasn't he?
I wouldn't say obsessed, George. I would say he was so full of enthusiasm for anything he drove himself into. Somebody said Hemingway would suck the air out of a room just by walking into it. You know, he had that liveness. He had this vitality. He put it in everything. He learned everything.
People like to be around him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's it. And that had its plus and minuses, too, because, of course, he attracted sycophants toward the end of his life.
Sure. Would he be considered bipolar today?
Probably. Yeah. Probably. But you know, labeling something as an illness doesn't explain away his genius.
Thomas in Sarasota, Florida. Go ahead, Thomas.
Hey, you know, I've had some weird experiences that I can't explain, but I am curious about, you know, when you communicated with him, have you ever heard an audio clip of his voice before, like, because, you know, he was in the 20th century, so, like, when you communicate with him, does a voice sound similar to what you've heard on other audio clips? Like, do you see him? Do you see him at a certain age? Do you just see a light? Or what, you know, just some of those kind of details. And I think I agree with what George might have been saying was that I bet, you know, everyone, you know, has some kind of political feelings. I mean, politics is just life. It's just dealing with people. And I think that if he was alive today, he would, be supporting the candidates on libertarianprogressive.com for independent parties.
Well, let me answer the first part, which is more to my experience. I don't get visuals. I don't get audio usually. What I get is a knowing, and I don't know how to describe it as better than that. As I say, it's more like a conversation where you say something and then more wells up beneath you. And as you express that, then more comes up after that. So it's very much in the form of a conversation. I don't know the words. I don't hear the words ahead of time. I hear them or they express, let's put it that way, as I write them down. Now, as I said, that one time with Fukushima, I really did hear it. Another time, stuff came spontaneously. But that's not the same thing as my getting a vision of him or hearing. I have heard audio clips from YouTube, and then it is interesting, his Nobel Prize winning thing. But there's nothing to compare it to because I don't get audios.
How difficult is it, Frank, for people to accept this, that you indeed had conversations with Ernest Hemingway?
I don't know. I guess I'll find out in the next few months.
You mean with book sales?
Yeah. Yeah, well...
Nah, book sales.
Hopefully with book sales.
Book sales won't be a guide for that.
Well, all I can tell you is like everybody else, I have people around me who are more like me than are like the general population. So my friends, they may or may not accept it, but they accept me. And so, you know.
Well, that's the important thing. Frank, once again, thanks for being on the program. Frank DeMarco, great noted author. When we come back in a moment, David Bloom joins us. Author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas, but why are these gasoline prices jumping up so high so fast? Let's get David's take on that, and then your calls in the last hour with him on Coast to Coast AM.